a holiday. The masterful wind was up and out, shouting and chasing, the lord of the morning. Poplars swayed and tossed with a roaring swish, dead leaves sprang aloft, and whirled into space, and all the clear swept heaven seemed to thrill with sound like a great harp. It was one of the first awakenings of the year. The earth stretched herself, smiling in her sleep, and everything leapt and pulsed to the stir of the giant's movement. With us it was a whole holiday, the occasion of birthday, it matters not whose. Some one of us had had presents, and pretty conventional speeches, and had glowed with that sense of heroism which is no less sweet that nothing has been done to deserve it. But the holiday was for all, the rapture of awakening nature for all, the various outdoor joys of puddles and sun and hedge breaking for all. Colt-like I ran through the meadows, frisking happy heels in the face of nature laughing responsive. Above, the sky was bluest of the blue, white pools left by the winter's floods flashed the color back, true and brilliant, and the soft air thrilled with the germinating touch that seemed to kindle something in my own small person as well as in the rash primrose already lurking in sheltered haunts. Out into the brimming sun-bathed world I sped, free of lessons, free of discipline and correction, for one day at least. My legs ran of themselves, and though I heard my name called faint and shrill behind, there was no stopping for me. It was only Harold, I concluded, and his legs, though shorter than mine, were good for a longer spurt than this. Then I heard it called again, but this time more faintly, with a pathetic break in the middle, and I pulled up short, recognizing Charlotte's plaintive note. She panted up and on, and dropped on the turf beside me. Neither had any desire for talk, the glow and the glory of existing on this perfect morning were satisfaction full and sufficient. "Where's Harold?" I asked presently. "Oh, he's just plain muffin man, as usual," said Charlotte with petulance. "Fancy wanting to be a muffin man on a whole holiday." It was a strange craze, certainly, but Harold, who invented his own games and played them without assistance, always stuck staunchly to a new fad, till he had worn it quite out. Just at present he was a muffin man, and day and night he went through passages and up and down staircases, ringing a noiseless bell and offering phantom muffins to invisible wayfarers. It sounds a poor sort of sport, and yet to pass along busy streets of your own building, forever ringing an imaginary bell and offering airy muffins of your own make to a bustling thronging crowd of your own creation, there were points about the game, it cannot be denied, though it seemed scarce in harmony with this radiant windswept morning. "And Edward, where is he?" I questioned again. "He's coming along by the road," said Charlotte. "He'll be crouching in the ditch when we get there, and he's going to be a grizzly bear and spring out on us, only you mustn't say I told you, 'cause it's to be a surprise." "All right," I said magnanimously. "Come on and let's be surprised." But I could not help feeling that on this day of days even a grizzly felt misplaced and common. Sure enough, an undeniable bear sprang out on us as we dropped into the road, then ensued shrieks, growlings, revolver shots, and unrecorded heroisms, till Edward condescended at last to roll over and die, bulking large and grim, an unmitigated grizzly. It was an understood thing, that whoever took upon himself to be a bear must eventually die, sooner or later, even if he were the eldest born, else, life would have been all strife and carnage, and the age of acorns have displaced our hard-won civilization. This little affair concluded with satisfaction to all parties concerned, we rambled along the road, picking up the defaulting Harold by the way, muffinless now and in his right and social mind. "What would you do?" asked Charlotte presently, the book of the moment always dominating her thoughts until it was sucked dry and cast aside. "What would you do if you saw two lions in the road, one on each side, and you didn't know if they was loose or if they was chained up?"
"Do?"
shouted Edward, valiantly. I should. His boastful accents died away into a mumble. "Dunno what I should do." "Shouldn't do anything," I observed after consideration, and really it would be difficult to arrive at a wiser conclusion. "If it came to doing," remarked Harold, reflectively, "the lions would do all the doing there was to do, wouldn't they?" "But if they was good lions," rejoined Charlotte, "they would do as they would be done by."
"Ah, but how are you to know a good lion from a bad one?" said Edward. "The books don't tell you at all, and the lions ain't marked any different."
"Why, there aren't any good lions," said Harold, hastily.
"Oh yes, there are, heaps and heaps," contradicted Edward. "Nearly all the lions in the storybooks are good lions. There was Androcles' lion, and St. Jerome's lion, and then the lion and the unicorn."
"He beat the unicorn," observed Harold, dubiously, "all round the town."
"That proves he was a good lion," cried Edwards triumphantly. "But the question is, How are you to tell him when you see him? _ I _ should ask Martha, said Harold of the Simple Creed. Edward snorted contemptuously, then turned to Charlotte. Look here, he said, let's play at lions, anyhow, and I'll run onto that corner and be a lion. I'll be two lions, one on each side of the road, and you'll come along, and you won't know whether I'm chained up or not, and that'll be the fun.
No, thank you, said Charlotte, firmly, you'll be chained up till I'm quite close to you, and then you'll be loose, and you'll tear me in pieces, and make my frock all dirty, and perhaps you'll hurt me as well. _ I_ know you're lions.
No, I won't, I swear I won't, protested Edward. I'll be quite a new lion this time, something you can't even imagine. And he raced off to his post. Charlotte hesitated, then she went timidly on, at each step growing less Charlotte, the mummer of a minute, and more the anxious pilgrim of all time. The lion's wrath waxed terrible at her approach, his roaring filled the startled air. I waited until they were both thoroughly absorbed, and then I slipped through the hedge out of the trodden highway, into the vacant meadow spaces. It was not that I was unsociable, nor that I knew Edward's lions to the point of satiety, but the passion and the call of the divine morning were high in my blood. Earth to earth. That was the frank note, the joyous summons of the day, and they could not but jar and seem artificial, these human discussions and pretenses, when boon nature, reticent no more, was singing that full-throated song of hers that thrills and claims control of every fiber. The air was wine, the moist earth smell, wine, the lark's song, the wafts from the cowshed at top of the field, the pant and smoke of a distant train, all were wine, or song, was it? Or odor, this unity they all blended into? I had no words then to describe it, that earth effluence of which I was so conscious, nor, indeed, have I found words since. I ran sideways, shouting, I dug glad heels into the squelching soil, I splashed diamond showers from puddles with a stick, I hurled clods skywards at random, and presently I somehow found myself singing. The words were mere nonsense, irresponsible babble, the tune was an improvisation, a weary, unrhythmic thing of rise and fall, and yet it seemed to me a genuine utterance, and just at that moment the one thing fitting and right and perfect. Humanity would have rejected it with scorn, nature, everywhere singing in the same key, recognized and accepted it without a flicker of dissent. All the time the hardy wind was calling to me companionably from where he swung and bellowed in the treetops. Take me for guide today, he seemed to plead. Other holidays you have tramped it in the track of the stolid, unswerving sun, a belated truant, you have dragged a weary foot homeward with only a pale, expressionless moon for company. Today why not I, the trickster, the hypocrite? I, who whip round corners and bluster, relapse and evade, then rally and pursue. I can lead you the best and rarest dance of any, for I am the strong capricious one, the lord of misrule, and I alone am irresponsible and unprincipled, and obey no law. And for me, I was ready enough to fall in with the fellow's humor, was not this a whole holiday? So we sheered off together, arm in arm, so to speak, and with fullest confidence I took the jigging, thwartwise course my chainless pilot laid for me. A whimsical comrade I found him, ere he had done with me. Was it in jest, or with some serious purpose of his own, that he brought me plump upon a pair of lovers, silent, face to face or a discreet unwinking style? As a rule this sort of thing struck me as the most pitiful tomfoolery. Two calves rubbing noses through a gate were natural and right and within the order of things, but that human beings, with salient interests and active pursuits beckoning them on from every side, could thus. Well, it was a thing to hurry past, shamed of face, and think on no more. But this morning everything I met seemed to be accounted for and set in tune by that same magical touch in the air, and it was with a certain surprise that I found myself regarding these fatuous ones with kindliness instead of contempt, as I rambled by, unheeded of them. There was indeed some reconciling influence abroad, which could bring the like antics into harmony with bud and growth and the frolic air. A puff on the right cheek from my willful companion sent me off at a fresh angle, and presently I came in sight of the village church, sitting solitary within its circle of elms. From forth the vestry window projected two small legs, gyrating, hungry for foothold, with larceny not to say sacrilege in their every wriggle, a godless sight for a supporter of the establishment. Though the rest was hidden, I knew the legs well enough, they were usually attached to the body of Bill Saunders, the peerless bad boy of the village. Bill's coveted booty, too, I could easily guess at that, it came from the vicar's store of biscuits, kept, as I knew, in a cupboard along with his official trappings. For a moment I hesitated, then I passed on my way. I protest I was not on Bill's side, but then, Neither was I on the Vickers, and there was something in this immoral morning which seemed to say that perhaps, after all, Bill had as much right to the biscuits as the vicar, and would certainly enjoy them better, and anyhow it was a disputable point, and no business of mine. Nature, who had accepted me for ally, cared little who had the world's biscuits, and assuredly was not going to let any friend of hers waste his time in playing policeman for society. He was tugging at me anew, my insistent guide, and I felt sure, as I rambled off in his wake, that he had more holiday matter to show me. And so, indeed, he had, and all of it was to the same lawless tune. Like a black pirate flag on the blue ocean of air, a hawk hung ominous, then, plummet-wise, dropped to the hedgerow, whence there rose, thin and shrill, a piteous voice of squealing. By the time I got there a whisk of feathers on the turf like scattered playbills was all that remained to tell of the tragedy just enacted. Yet nature smiled and sang on, pitiless, gay, impartial. To her, who took no sides, there was every bit as much to be said for the hawk as for the chaffinch. Both were her children, and she would show no preferences. Further on, a hedgehog lay dead athwart the path, nay, more than dead, decadent, distinctly, a sorry sight for one that had known the fellow in more bustling circumstances. Nature might at least have paused to shed one tear over this rough-jacketed little son of hers, for his wasted aims, his cancelled ambitions, his whole career of usefulness cut suddenly short. But not a bit of it. Jubilant as ever, her song went bubbling on, and death and life, and again, life and death, were its alternate burdens. And looking round, and seeing the sheep-nibbled heels of turnips that dotted the ground, their hearts eaten out of them in frost-bound days now over and done, I seemed to discern, faintly, a something of the stern meaning in her valorous chant. My invisible companion was singing also, and seemed at times to be chuckling softly to himself, doubtless at thought of the strange new lessons he was teaching me, perhaps, too, at a special bit of waggishness he had still in store. For when at last he grew weary of such insignificant earthbound company, he deserted me at a certain spot I knew, then dropped, subsided, and slunk away into nothingness. I raised my eyes, and before me, grim and lichened, stood the ancient whipping post of the village, its sides fretted with the initials of a generation that scorned its mute lesson, but still clipped by the stout rusty shackles that had tethered the wrists of such of that generation's ancestors as had dared to mock at order and law. Had I been an infant stern, here was a grand chance for sentimental output. As things were, I could only hurry homewards, my moral tail well between my legs, with an uneasy feeling, as I glanced back over my shoulder, that there was more in this chance than met the eye. And outside our gate I found Charlotte, alone and crying. Edward, it seemed, had persuaded her to hide, in the full expectation of being duly found and ecstatically pounced upon. Then he had caught sight of the butcher's cart, and, forgetting his obligations, had rushed off for a ride. Harold, it further appeared, greatly coveting tadpoles, and top-heavy with the eagerness of possession, had fallen into the pond. This, in itself, was nothing, but on attempting to sneak in by the back door, he had rendered up his duckweed-bedabbled person into the hands of an aunt, and had been promptly sent off to bed, and this, on a holiday, was very much. The moral of the whipping post was working itself out, and I was not in the least surprised when, on reaching home, I was seized upon and accused of doing something I had never even thought of. And my frame of mind was such, that I could only wish most heartily that I had done it. A whitewashed uncle. In our small lives that day was eventful when another uncle was to come down from town, and submit his character and qualifications, albeit unconsciously, to our careful criticism. Previous uncles had been weighed in the balance, and alas, found grievously wanting. There was Uncle Thomas a failure from the first. Not that his disposition was malevolent, nor were his habits such as to unfit him for decent society, but his rooted conviction seemed to be that the reason of a child's existence was to serve as a butt for senseless adult jokes, or what, from the accompanying guffaws of laughter, appeared to be intended for jokes. Now, we were anxious that he should have a perfectly fair trial, so in the toolhouse, between breakfast and lessons, we discussed and examined all his witticisms, one by one, calmly, critically, dispassionately. It was no good, we could not discover any salt in them. And as only a genuine gift of humor could have saved Uncle Thomas, for he pretended to naught besides, he was reluctantly writ down a hopeless impostor. Uncle George the youngest was distinctly more promising. He accompanied us cheerily round the establishment, suffered himself to be introduced to each of the cows, held out the right hand of fellowship to the pig, and even hinted that a pair of pink-eyed Himalayan rabbits might arrive unexpectedly from town some day. We were just considering whether in this fertile soil an apparently accidental remark on the solid qualities of guinea pigs or ferrets might haply blossom and bring forth fruit, when our governess appeared on the scene. Uncle George's manner at once underwent a complete and contemptible change. His interest in rational topics seemed, like a fountain's sickening pulse, to flag in every way, and though Miss Smedley's ostensible purpose was to take Selina for her usual walk, I can vouch for it that Selina spent her morning ratting, along with the keeper's boy and me, while, if Miss Smedley walked with anyone, it would appear to have been with Uncle George. But despicable as his conduct had been, he underwent no hasty condemnation. The defection was discussed in all its bearings, but it seemed sadly clear at last that this uncle must possess some innate badness of character and fondness for low company. We who from daily experience knew Miss Smedley like a book were we not only too well aware that she had neither accomplishments nor charms, no characteristic, in fact, but an inbred viciousness of temper and disposition? True, she knew the dates of the English kings by heart, but how could that profit Uncle George, who, having passed into the army, had ascended beyond the need of useful information? Our bows and arrows, on the other hand, had been freely placed at his disposal, and a soldier should not have hesitated in his choice a moment. Number Uncle George had fallen from grace, and was unanimously damned. And the non-arrival of the Himalayan rabbits was only another nail in his coffin. Uncles, therefore, were just then a heavy and lifeless market, and there was little inclination to deal. Still it was agreed that Uncle William, who had just returned from India, should have as fair a trial as the others, more especially as romantic possibilities might well be embodied in one who had held the gorgeous Eastern fee. Selina had kicked my shins like the girl she is. During a scuffle in the passage, and I was still rubbing them with one hand when I found that the uncle on approbation was half-heartedly shaking the other. A florid, elderly man, and unmistakably nervous, he dropped our grimy paws in succession, and, turning very red, with an awkward simulation of heartiness, "Well, HRY all?" he said, "glad to see me, eh?" As we could hardly, in justice, be expected to have formed an opinion on him at that early stage, we could but look at each other in silence, which scarce served to relieve the tension of the situation. Indeed, the cloud never really lifted during his stay. In talking it over later, someone put forward the suggestion that he must at some time or other have committed a stupendous crime, but I could not bring myself to believe that the man, though evidently unhappy, was really guilty of anything, and I caught him once or twice looking at us with evident kindliness, though seeing himself observed, he blushed and turned away his head. When at last the atmosphere was clear of this depressing influence, we met despondently in the potato cellar all of us, that is, but Harold, who had been told off to accompany his relative to the station, and the feeling was unanimous, that, at an uncle, William could not be allowed to pass. Selina roundly declared him a beast, pointing out that he had not even got us a half holiday, and, indeed, there seemed little to do but to pass sentence. We were about to put it, when Harold appeared on the scene, his red face, round eyes, and mysterious demeanor, hinting at awful portents. Speechless he stood a space, then, slowly drawing his hand from the pocket of his knickerbockers, he displayed on a dirty palm 1, 2, 3, 4 half crowns. We could but gaze tranced, breathless, mute. Never had any of us seen, in the aggregate, so much bullion before. Then Harold told his tale. "I took the old fellow to the station," he said, "and as we went along I told him all about the station master's family, and how I had seen the porter kissing our housemaid, and what a nice fellow he was, with no airs or affectation about him, and anything I thought would be of interest, but he didn't seem to pay much attention, but walked along puffing his cigar, and once I thought, I'm not certain, but I thought I heard him say, 'Well, thank God, that's over.' When we got to the station he stopped suddenly, and said, 'Hold on a minute.' Then he shoved these into my hand in a frightened sort of way, and said, 'Look here, youngster. These are for you and the other kids. Buy what you like, make little beasts of yourselves, only don't tell the old people, mind. Now cut away home.' So I cut." A solemn hush fell on the assembly, broken first by the small Charlotte. "I didn't know," she observed dreamily, "that there were such good men anywhere in the world. I hope he'll die tonight, for then he'll go straight to heaven." But the repentant Selina bewailed herself with tears and sobs, refusing to be comforted, for that in her haste she had called this white's old relative a beast. "I'll tell you what we'll do," said Edward, the mastermind, rising as he always did to the situation. "We'll christen the piebald pig after him, the one that hasn't got a name yet. And that'll show we're sorry for our mistake." "I christened that pig this morning," Harold guiltily confessed. I christened it after the curate. I'm very sorry, but he came in bow to me last night, after you others had all been sent to bed early, and somehow I felt I had to do it.
Oh, but that doesn't count, said Edward hastily, because we weren't all there. We'll take that christening off, and call it Uncle William. And you can save up the curate for the next litter.
And the motion being agreed to without a division, the house went into committee of supply, alarms and excursions.
Let's pretend, suggested Harold, that we're cavaliers and roundheads, and you be a roundhead.
Oh bother, I replied drowsily, we pretended that yesterday, and it's not my turn to be a roundhead, anyhow. The fact is, I was lazy, and the call to arms fell on indifferent ears. We three younger ones were stretched at length in the orchard. The sun was hot, the season merry June, and never, I thought, had there been such wealth and riot of buttercups throughout the lush grass. Green and gold was the dominant key that day. Instead of active pretense with its shouts and perspiration, how much better I held to lie at ease and pretend to one's self, in green and golden fancies, slipping the husk and passing, a careless lounger, through a sleepy imaginary world all gold and green. But the persistent Harold was not to be fobbed of.
Well, then, he began afresh, let's pretend we're knights of the round table, and, with a rush, _I_LL_B_Lancelot.
I won't play unless I'm Lancelot, I said. I didn't mean it really, but the game of knights always began with this particular contest.
Oh please, implored Harold. You know when Edward's here I never get a chance of being Lancelot. I haven't been Lancelot for weeks.
Then I yielded gracefully.
All right, I said. I'll be Tristram.
Oh, but you can't, cried Harold again.
Charlotte has always been Tristram. She won't play unless she's allowed to be Tristram. Be somebody else this time.
Charlotte said nothing, but breathed hard, looking straight before her. The peerless hunter in Harper was her special hero of romance, and rather than see the part in less appreciative hands, she would even have returned sadly to the stuffy schoolroom.
I don't care, I said, I'll be anything. I'll be Sir Kay. Come on.
Then once more in this country story the mail-clad knights paced through the greenwood shaw, questing adventure, redressing wrong, and bandits, 5-1, broke and fled discomfited to their caves. Once again were damsels rescued, dragons disemboweled, and giants, in every corner of the orchard, deprived of their already superfluous number of heads, while Palamides the Saracen waited for us by the well, and Sir Bruce Sanspeter vanished in craven flight before the skilled spear that was his terror and his bane. Once more the lists were dight in Camelot, and all was gay with shimmer of silk and gold, the earth shook with thunder of horses, ash staves flew in splinters, and the firmament rang to the clash of sword on helm. The varying fortune of the day swung doubtful now on this side, now on that, till at last Lancelot, grim and great, thrusting through the press, unhorsed Sir Tristram, an easy task, and bestrode her, threatening doom, while the Cornish knight, forgetting hard-won fame of old, cried piteously, "You're hurting me, I tell you. And you're tearing my frock." Then it happed that Sir Kay, hurtling to the rescue, stopped short in his stride, catching sight suddenly, through apple boughs, of a gleam of scarlet afar off, while the confused tramp of many horses, mingled with talk and laughter, was borne to our ears.
"What is it?" inquired Tristram, sitting up and shaking out her curls, while Lancelot forsook the clanging lists and trotted nimbly to the hedge.
I stood spellbound for a moment longer, and then, with a cry of soldiers, I was off to the hedge, Charlotte picking herself up and scurrying after. Down the road they came, two and two, at an easy walk, scarlet flamed in the eye, bits jingled and saddles squeaked delightfully, while the men, in a halo of dust, smoked their short clays like the heroes they were. In a swirl of intoxicating glory the troop clinked and clattered by, while we shouted and waved, jumping up and down, and the big jolly horsemen acknowledged the salute with easy condescension. The moment they were past we were through the hedge and after them. Soldiers were not the common stuff of everyday life. There had been nothing like this since the winter before last, when on a certain afternoon bare of leaf and monochrome in its hue of sodden fallow and frost-nipped copse suddenly the hounds had burst through the fence with their mellow cry, and all the paddock was for the minute reverberant of thudding hoof and dotted with glancing red. But this was better, since it could only mean that blows and bloodshed were in the air.
"Is there going to be a battle?" panted Harold, hardly able to keep up for excitement.
"Of course there is," I replied. "We're just in time. Come on." Perhaps I ought to have known better, and yet, the pigs and poultry, with whom we chiefly consorted, could instruct us little concerning the peace that in these latter days lapped this secret realm. In the schoolroom we were just now dallying with the Wars of the Roses, and did not legends of the countryside inform us how cavaliers had once galloped up and down these very lanes from their quarters in the village? Here, now, were soldiers unmistakable, and if their business was not fighting, what was it? Sniffing the joy of battle, we followed hard on their tracks. "Won't Edward be sorry," puffed Harold, "that he's begun that beastly Latin?" It did, indeed, seem hard. Edward, the most martial spirit of us all, was drearily conjugating amo, of all verbs, between four walls, while Selina, who ever thrilled ecstatic to her red coat, was struggling with the uncouth German tongue. Age, I reflected, carries its penalties. It was a grievous disappointment to us that the troop passed through the village unmolested. Every cottage, I pointed out to my companions, ought to have been loopholed, and strongly held. But no opposition was offered to the soldiers, who, indeed, conducted themselves with a recklessness and a want of precaution that seemed simply criminal. At the last cottage a transitory gleam of common sense flickered across me, and, turning on Charlotte, I sternly ordered her back. The small maiden, docile but exceedingly dolorous, dragged reluctant feet homewards, heavy at heart that she was to behold no stout fellows slain that day, but Harold and I held steadily on, expecting every instant to see the environing hedges crackle and spit forth the leaden death. "Will they be Indians?" inquired my brother, meaning the enemy, or roundheads, or what? I reflected. Harold always required direct, straightforward answers, not faltering suppositions. "They won't be Indians," I replied at last, "nor yet roundheads. There haven't been any roundheads seen about here for a long time. They'll be Frenchmen." Harold's face fell. "All right," he said, "Frenchmen will do, but I did hope they'd be Indians." "If they were going to be Indians," I explained, I don't think I'd go on. "Because when Indians take you prisoner they scalp you first, and then burn you at a stake. But Frenchmen don't do that sort of thing." "Are you quite sure?" asked Harold doubtfully. "Quite," I replied. "Frenchmen only shut you up in a thing called the Bastille, and then you get a file sent into you in a loaf of bread, and saw the bars through, and slide down a rope, and they all fire at you but they don't hit you, and you run down to the seashore as hard as you can, and swim off to a British frigate, and there you are." Harold brightened up again. The program was rather attractive. "If they try to take us prisoner," he said, we won't run, will we?" Meanwhile, the craven foe was a long time showing himself, and we were reaching strange outland country, uncivilized, wherein lions might be expected to prowl at nightfall. I had a stitch in my side, and both Harold's stockings had come down. Just as I was beginning to have gloomy doubts of the proverbial courage of Frenchmen,